places, everyone. Quiet on the set. Curtains in five.
Hello, and welcome back to Footlights, a community theater podcast coming to you from the studios of WVIK Radio on the beautiful campus of Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. And to give you some context, we're recording this episode on October 14th. I'm Chris Hicks, and returning today as guest host is the amazing Jake Ladd.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Well, I love having you on. And welcome, and thank you for joining me today. I think we're in for an interesting conversation with our guest, James Driscoll, who has told me I can call him Jim.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Okay, so I only know this about you, other than what I've seen you on stage. I know you're an accomplished actor. You've tackled some iconic roles, and you're retired. So fill us in from there. How long have you been in theater? Have you been in the Quad Cities all this time? Give us your background, please.
It sounds like you read the bio from the last show I was in.
I always read the bios.
Which is the Woman in Black at Richmond Hill just this past weekend.
Oh, I was going to mention that you're fresh off the Woman in Black.
Well, I've been in the Quad Cities for about 35 years, a transplant from the East Coast. And I moved out here to raise a family. When my wife and I at the time started family, she did not want to raise children in New England. Too expensive, too crowded, too much traffic.
How did you choose the Quad Cities?
She was originally an Eastern Iowa native. You know, we met in the military. We got married. She said, it's Connecticut or Iowa. She wanted Iowa. We moved back here. I was a government employee at the time. Worked for a large organization that had offices everywhere.
I was going to ask you, because I know that you're a G-man.
I was
a former G-man, so I wanted to ask you about
that. I was with the Treasury Department, it's true. And they transferred me from the Hartford office to the Davenport office back in the early 1990s. And I stayed.
Well, that is interesting. Now I see why you did so well in A Few Good Men. You have military background.
That was an aid to me. It was actually an aid for my very first show.
And also, that's almost counterintuitive to being on stage, coming from a disciplined, shall I say, background like the military.
Well, I don't know. The stage requires some discipline. You have to have the ability to memorize the lines, to follow direction. You must have some input on that, sir.
I'd love to hear about the idea that there are actors who appreciate some professional discipline. So
it's the director's show. We're just the pawns of the director on stage, to my way of thinking. Actors, they go on and say, well, I don't listen to the director. I'll do it the way I want to do it. I don't necessarily appreciate that approach.
Well, I have a question for Jim. Of course, Jim, you didn't tell me that I could call you Jim, so if that's
please
okay.
Do.
Okay.
Please do.
All right. So, Colonel Jessup, Willie Loman, Biff Loman.
Oh, you've played both parts?
I did.
Okay.
Or I have.
And these are iconic roles, and there's so many. Jim is sitting between us. Between us is, Jim has done everything. Every iconic role that an actor wants to do, he has done, except I saw an interview with Tristan, and you divulged a part that you've wanted to play. So I'm going to ask if you'll share that with Chris's audience and tell us whether in the interim you have had a chance to do that.
Well, can I change the show that I mentioned to Tristan in that interview?
Of course.
Because I have given that a lot of thought since then, and there are actually two shows that I still would love to do.
Well, then you have to tell us both of them.
Well, I don't know that either of them will be done, though they've tried around here and I'm sure in other parts of the country. But the first one is Long Day's Journey and Tonight, O'Neill.
And, ooh, that's heavy.
And I know there's some directors around here that would love a chance to direct that on one of the local stages.
I can guarantee one venue that will not do it.
I know there. I don't know that I could convince a venue to do it because I don't know that they would be able to sell enough tickets to make it worthwhile. It is a long, complicated drama.
O'Neill, how could that be?
Yeah. But I would love for a chance to audition for the role of the father in that play. And there's some fantastic actresses in the Quad Cities that would play the Katharine Hepburn role from the movie just fantastically. The son roles are wonderful as well. It would just be great to do. So if there's any theater owners in the area that are looking for a drama, they should consider Long Day's Journey Into Night. And the second show that I have seen, actually.
Oh, which one is the one you told Tristan to begin with?
Oh.
It wasn't Long Day's Journey?
No.
Okay.
It was
I just wanted to know which one was
done
which.
Around here before John Vandy Woosteen played the lead role on Golden Pond.
Oh, yes.
And that, he surprised me with the question, and it was the first thing that came to my mind for an aging actor like myself. You know, I can't play the dad roles anymore, kind of looking for the grandfather roles.
Well, you can play the dad roles.
Well, I think you can play the dad roles.
Older children.
That's right, older children, that's all. So.
There's a play called The Outgoing Tide by Graham that Newground Theater, I believe, was going to put on before they folded. They tried to put on a couple of years in a row,
yes.
And just had some difficulties. I read the script. I just loved it. It's a dark comedy.
Yes.
And I wish another theater in this area would try and put that on stage.
Chris, that is it's a phenomenally written play, and it deals with the topic of family relations, father and son, and dementia, and it's...
Oh, well, that would be a perfect play for Black Box. Or is it too... What's the word I want? Too elaborately staged?
Oh, I don't believe so.
No, it's just, it is a heavy story. And, it would certainly work well on that stage, I think. But then again, I don't make those decisions over there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well.
Thank you for letting me get the pitch out there for it.
Well,
I agree, it's a wonderfully written script.
It is.
I miss Mockingbird on Main, too. Did you ever do anything there? I don't recall.
Just the, not at the Davenport location, but Mockingbird on Main did To Kill a Mockingbird at the Black Box Theater as their last show.
That's right. And, okay.
I was privileged to be a part of that production.
And you did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
So, you mentioned that show was a dark comedy. And when we were chatting out in the reception area, I said, I have never seen you. That doesn't mean that you haven't done it. I just haven't seen you in a comedy. Have you ever been in a comedy? Would you ever want to be in a comedy?
I love doing comedies. They sell tickets in this area particularly. I have done many. Playcrafters, Richmond Hill. I like Neil Simon. I like the older comedy, so I've done Proposals. And even way, way back in high school, I was in Barefoot in the Park with the Victor Velasco role of the upstairs neighbor. Back when everyone's 17 years old, so they had to spray paint my hair silver. And
you don't need to do that these days.
No, I don't need to
neither
do that.
Well, neither do I, so, you know.
Pointing that out to our radio
now,
audience.
You know, you put too much on that. Yes, you have. I actually would love to have your color hair. I don't know what. I had a maternal aunt who was snow white hair, and I wanted to have that color hair. Never got it. But to say that it limits you age-wise, I had a school bus driver in grade school who turned snow white. Her hair turned snow white in her 20s. So I don't think that's a big deal.
No, it's you asked about comedy.
That's why I say you could play a father, because facially you don't look decrepit and, you know, like grandfather age. So,
I played in Proposals, I believe Neil Simon's Proposals, 25 years ago at Playcrafters. And I was the oldest person that auditioned. I was in my late 30s. And so being the oldest person that auditioned, they cast me in the father role. And I think he was supposed to be 62.
No.
So they silvered Powder. My hair up for that role. And, you know, 25 years later, the father in that role, when Playcrafters did it again, broke his arm. And they called me the week before the opening and said, could you replace an actor? And I said, well, sure. And they said, well, we're rehearsing tomorrow night, you know, at 6:30. Can you come in? They did not know I had done the part 25 years before.
Oh, really?
So I said, I'll be there.
So they were impressed how fast you memorized those lines, eh?
Well, they handed me the script. I had had my script at home from the previous rendition of the play and had already rememorized the part. They handed me the script and I fanned it and I kind of threw it on the stage. I said, okay, let's go. And it was still Playcrafters with the thrust stage, so the blocking hadn't changed all that much. So the other actors on stage would just give me little subtle hand gestures about where I was supposed to stand for the different scenes, and I went through it without having to look at the script. And they're like, how can you do that?
Who directed you that time? Do you remember?
I wish I could say I remembered, but I do not. It was just before COVID. Don Faust, local actor, who's the exact same age as
he
me.
He is the sweetest guy.
We auditioned for a lot of the same parts, but he's the one who broke his arm and couldn't go on.
Oh, really?
So they said, well, you know, maybe Jim can do it. So that was fun. I like kind of stepping in. I've done that two or three times.
Well, I want to see you in a comedy now.
All right. I look at all of the local community theaters and the slates of shows that they announce for the coming season, and you know, at my calendar, look at who's directing the shows, because that's important to me. It's not just the script. It's, you know, who's directing and whether it's going to be a pleasurable experience.
Yeah. I agree with that. Because Jake can confirm this. I'm very intense when I'm in a play. I get so wrapped up, but we're not here to talk about me.
Well, we can. Oh. It's interesting to me, more interesting than hearing about myself.
So. Well, you know all about yourself.
I do.
Yeah.
Well, what I can remember.
Now, I've seen your name in credits in programs for Crew. What was it? You helped build sets at Black Box. I was going to say Black Hawk.
Yeah, at Black Box, the Half-Life of Marie Curie. I think she might have overstated that. I went in and helped her, Laura Adams' husband, Michael, build the set there. But I think I more fetched and carried and nailed what he told me to do.
So you don't consider yourself a handyman in that respect?
Not particularly.
Ah. You know? Have you ever directed?
No, and I have no desire to. I stage managed The Fox on the Fairway at Richmond Hill this past summer. It's my first time stage managing. Wanted to experience at that, and the director of the show was a friend of mine. Was having a little problem with his knees and getting around. Didn't know if he'd be able to direct if he didn't have someone that could fetch and carry for him. And I said, well, you know, I'll do it, Tom. And so we
do you live on this side of the river or in Iowa?
I live in Bettendorf.
Bettendorf. That's a long haul out to Geneseo.
30 minutes. Well, the commercial says drive 20, save plenty. You know, in Geneseo, I won't mention the name of the company, but...
Well, it is about 20 minutes from Moline.
Yep.
And not the last time, because we went out interstate, because the show before The Woman in Black, we went out Route 6. That's the most direct
from where I live. Closure?
And I hit the road closure, yeah, and I thought, oh, no, or we're going to be late. Because we had to turn around and go back on the interstate. I hope they get that done soon.
That was me knocking on wood. Hopefully all the construction's done before winter. So
we discovered why you moved, how you moved. What happened next?
Well, as I said, we moved out here to start a family. That marriage did not last, as sometimes happens. And I was a single individual looking for things to do, and I saw an advertisement in the Quad City Times back when they used to do advertising.
They used to cover theater?
And it was for open auditions for the Kane Mutiny Court Martial at Playcrafters Barn Theater in 2000, year 2000. And I looked at that and I said, well.
Was that your first involvement in the Quad Cities?
Yes. I said, I can be an Army or a Navy officer. I was an Army officer. I said, they're similar enough. And so I went out to the auditions and I had just done that one high school bit. So I went on the audition sheet, I listed no experience, just put my name and address. And we went through the auditions and the director there said, if you don't come to my auditions, you don't get cast. I don't reach out to people and cast them after the fact. And there were 13 roles, all for men. It's an all-male show.
Sure.
And there were 13 people at the auditions. And after the auditions were done, he said, congratulations.
You're
all of you are going to be cast. I'm not sure exactly which role each of you is going to get. But you are going to be cast because there are 13 roles and there are 13 of you.
If they only had one audition? They didn't have...
It was 2 days of auditions, one weekend.
And out of 2 days, only 13 showed up? Oh, my gosh.
And he called me and said, you read extremely well, but you have no experience, and so I can't give you the Captain Queeg role that Humphrey Bogart played. I'm not going to give that role to someone with no stage experience. He said, but I'd like to offer you the role of the prosecutor. It's the second largest part, and he's on stage the entire show. Would you accept that? I said, I auditioned. Of course I'll accept it. And it got me hooked. I did 5 shows in a row at Playcrafters after
that.
Just auditioned and auditioned, and that's when I got to play Biff Loman in The Death of a Salesman at Playcrafters in 2001 with John Vandy Woosteen, a local icon.
Mm.
I like to follow in his footsteps whenever I can because he played the great roles and did them all so well at Music Guild in Richmond Hill and Playcrafters. Rest in peace, John.
Now, I was surprised that you had been at Music Guild.
Yes.
You strike me as a straight play actor, but tell me what shows you were in there.
Oh, goodness.
He's wincing.
Someone saw me at Playcrafters and said, you should come out to Music Guild. And I said, well, when I was in elementary school, in 5th grade, we were doing the Christmas play, and the teacher in charge of the play had us all line up and sing a Christmas carol. I forget which one it was, Jingle Bells or Rudolph or whatnot. And she went down the line and listened to each 5th grade student sing. And when she got to me, I was singing whatever the Christmas carol was, she put her hand over my mouth and said, you know, made the gesture of don't sing anymore. And went down the rest of the line, and they made me the narrator for that show. I tell that story, other people in there are appalled. Like, how could a teacher do that? But...
Well, our producers do that all the time with me still, but, you know, it's a very different
reason.
Well,
you have something in common with Mr. Hicks.
So I thought I could not sing for...
Mr. Hicks cannot sing.
40 years. So I would not sing in public. So when they asked me to audition a musical, I said, well, I'll go out there, but I'll only audition for non-singing parts. So I went out and auditioned and got cast in the 1940s Radio Hour as the Foley artist. I was on stage the whole time. It was a lot of fun. Met a lot of new people. But it got me on stage at Music Guild, which some years ago maybe had a reputation for being
clickish.
A little clickish, where if you weren't already in, mm-hmm. it was hard to get in
there. That was true of just about all the theaters in the Quad Cities.
I never found it to be true. For the theaters that I've gone to, they've all been very welcoming, and you know, Music Guild included. They cast me, and they asked me to audition again for other shows, and... One director said, we had someone drop, and it's just a 2-line walk-on at the intermission. Can you just come and walk on stage, do the 2 lines, and leave? And I said, okay, I'll do
that.
Why
do I get those kind of parts?
Well, you know, I'm friendly and accommodating, I guess, and my government job left me with the evenings free, so they knew I'd be there for rehearsals. But I went and did that, and then the director said, you know, you have a pleasing voice. He said, I bet you could sing. And I said, well, I don't want to really. We just had another character drop out. He's got a solo. Where you take the Mr. Marichek part, and she loves me. Well, I'll try it. And the actor, the character, was a Czech shop owner.
Sure.
So I was able to do it in character with a voice. I find that if I can do the singing in an English accent or a Czech accent or a funny accent...
Then no one puts their hand over your mouth.
I'm less self-conscious about my singing ability, and I can sort of carry a tune. And then I did a few other shows, 1940s Radio Christmas Hour, where I got to do some harmonies with some of the local singers.
And that was something I was going to ask Chris, to ask Jim about. You've done quite a few staged radio shows.
Yes.
And not too many people get that opportunity, so I was curious if you would be interested in telling us more about that as well.
Well, when COVID hit, most of the local area community theaters were forced to shut their doors, or chose to shut their doors. I was in a production at Richmond Hill. We were halfway through rehearsal process when they announced the season was going to be canceled.
Oh, wow.
But Laura Adams at the Black Box Theater did not want to close for an indefinite period of time, so she started doing radio shows. Because with a radio show, the interaction between the actors is not necessarily close. She was able to put the actors at microphones. The first year with masks, the clear plexiglass masks, and do those shows and still have an audience come in and social space at the beginning. And we did War of the Worlds. We did a couple of Dick Tracy radio shows.
Oh, cool.
She did several more after that. Some I was involved in, some I wasn't. But to hear the old radio scripts with the commercials still written in as they were done in the 30s and the early 40s, it was just hilarious. And it was easier to do because the actors could hold their scripts. So you didn't necessarily have to memorize 2 hours. So sometimes we'd go 4 or 5 rehearsals and then we'd be up for an audience and she'd be able to do a show every month. And even with only being able to sell half the tickets with the required social distancing, she was able to sell enough tickets to pay the rent to keep the doors open.
I actually did that. Another theater person from Genesia's Guild, we formed a group and we performed radio scripts. This was before COVID. But we went to the audiences. We performed at a lot of the retirement communities.
Oh, wonderful.
They loved it, and it was really interesting because a lot of them would... Mr. Hicks did the sound effects, and they would sit next to him, as close as they could get to him, because they wanted to see how the things were done.
Oh, everyone loves the Foley artist, right?
Yep.
And we did the stuff like Fibber McGee and Molly and Our Miss Brooks. And
I've just been listening to the Burns and Allen radio shows from the 30s and 40s. Online, and the Jack Benny.
I've got Sirius XM's channel of the old radio shows on all the time in my car.
It's just wonderful. I wish they would do those around here again.
And the first show we did was at the community where my mom and dad were. And bless her heart, my mom went around and took brownies to everybody at the community to entice them to come to the show.
Did it work?
It did.
Can't fault that, then.
And we also performed at Burlington. The Burlington radio station the Burlington Library. We performed there, but the Burlington radio station promoted it. We had standing room only at that show. They were pulling benches from all over. They had a conference room set up, but then they were pulling benches in from all over the library because so many people showed up. That was really fun. So, what else?
Well, I have a question. What are you working on next?
Well, I did just finish a show 2 days ago. And they've just started to announce the slates for the upcoming 2026 seasons at the different theaters. So I'm in a holding pattern waiting for the spring auditions or winter auditions, depending.
That's true. We're coming to the end of the quote-unquote theater season, mm-hmm. because with the holidays coming,
yeah, there's still a few shows to come up to be seen. The Thanksgiving play at Black Box and Sound of Music at Music Guild.
Right.
But those
and there's one more out at
Richmond
Hill, too.
They are doing a comedy, a holiday comedy, a Sherlock Carol.
That's right.
A mashup between Sherlock Holmes and Scrooge. So I plan on going to see that. Even though I'm not in the comedies as often, I do like to see them as much as the next person. Oh, I did 39 Steps. That's a comedy.
That's
I did it
right.
at Playcrafters 15 years ago. So I have done a comedy that you might know.
I saw 39 Steps at Richmond Hill.
Yes.
And they did a fabulous job of
yes,
that.
Yes, it's a hilarious play.
The guy who... That one speech that's so rapid fire towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how anybody can memorize that and say that fast. And he's the guy. I can't think of his name, but you'll probably know who I'm talking about. He was on Off-Broadway, and he was just in a show recently, too.
Yeah.
He was in the also the show where the two grandparents... Sets of grandparents try to keep their grandson.
Was it Kevin Babbitt?
Yes, Kevin. He is phenomenal.
The theater director at Scott Community College?
Yes,
he's a fantastic actor. Seen him in dramas and comedies. His timing's perfect. So.
Yep. Well, what else? Did you do theater before you got to adulthood?
No, just that high school show.
And your fifth grade?
And the fifth grade
narrator.
Where I played the narrator. So then there was a long gap.
Now, what rank were you in the military?
I was an intelligence officer. So.
Ooh.
Yes, spy.
So you can't talk about it.
I'm not supposed to. At least some of the things. They say your clearance lasts forever. The security clearance, you're not supposed to talk about the...
Really?
Stuff that you did forever.
Well, that's kind
and ever.
Of interesting.
Unless it's been declassified, and no one is reaching out to me to tell me that the things I worked on are now declassified. So, best if we just not.
Well, how? I'm not. This is probably a stupid question, but how did that? Did you model Colonel Jessup, for example, on somebody that you knew in the military? Or are you just that mean?
I hate to admit this, but I talked with Tristan Tapscott about this briefly. When you're playing an iconic role
mm-hmm.
on stage and there's been a famous movie, the audiences have... an expectation
right.
of what they're going to see on stage. And if you don't give them at least a bit of that, they're going to be either disappointed or upset or confused, most of them, or too many. And so for A Few Good Men with Colonel Jessup, you know, I love the movie. I saw the Jack Nicholson portrayal. I don't think anyone could
Did
have done
Did you find
it
that intimidating?
Yes, of course. And I was trying to channel Jack in the stage role with the iconic, you know, you can't handle the truth scene. The rest of it, I tried to make mine based on what I knew as a military officer, and there was a couple of other people in the cast who were prior service as well, and so we knew how the military people acted and behaved, and we tried to impart that to the others. And but for the iconic courtroom scene...
Right.
It was the movie.
You know, this was several years ago, and I don't remember the name of the theater group, but they performed, they didn't last long. And I don't know if it was because people were not acclimated to their venue. For a while, they tried to perform in the old Rock Island Argus building. And I'm almost sure they did A Few Good Men, and...
That's where we did it. Yes, it was Tristan Tapscott's District Theater. Lasted 2 years. Got a chance to do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf there, too. Another heavy...
iconic role.
So Jonathan Graff was in A Few Good Men with you at that venue.
No, Jonathan Graff did A Few Good Men at Richmond Hill Theater years before.
I could have sworn he was in that show.
He was not in the one at the
Obviously,
District Theater.
I'm hallucinating.
Oh, he's done so many roles, though, at the different theaters. Jonathan Graff, past president of Richmond Hill.
Richmond Hill, sure.
Current president of Richmond Hill again.
Oh.
Yes, and he
just was, got... Have you worked with Jennifer Kingrey?
Yes, I have. She's directed me in several shows.
I think she's a good director. I really like
her
how
shows
she does
are always
stuff.
Technically precise. I mean, she knows what she's doing. Has the California experience similar to yours? I think she was in the directorial sphere out there, at least for a few years. Not as extensive as you.
No, I was just thinking that whether that is a California thing. It may actually may nobody's ever mentioned that before, but it may be that it is because the film and TV industry is so prominent that you do think of an approach to theater as being more technically precise. But no one's ever accused me of directing a show and being technically precise. So
I don't know about that.
I'm professionally demanding, definitely, but.
I could have said production values are very high with a Jennifer Kingrey show. She puts in the time and the effort to make sure the actors know their roles, that the lights and the sound and the special effects
sure.
and the makeup and costume are all appropriate. I mean, she does her homework.
I forgot now, who directed, Dana? Directed
Dana
The
Skiles
Woman in Black?
Directed The Woman in Black.
Yeah. She's, the only thing that I think... The final scene where the woman in black is up high above the, like, by the...
Balcony.
Yeah. I wouldn't have seen that if Mr. Hicks hadn't pointed. The light was not enough to draw my attention, and I thought a clap of thunder would have helped that.
I'll pass that along to Dana for if she does the show again.
Too late now. Yes. And that's just my opinion. Mm. But
I never got to see her on that balcony because I was facing away every rehearsal and every performance. So
and you know,
she was behind
I didn't
me.
Notice that your character didn't have a name until I started to write my review.
Yes. The actor.
The actor, yeah. But that's kind of like the princess in Love's Labor's Lost. She doesn't have a name either.
And I read your review and your comment about the costumes.
Yeah.
I agreed. I had a chance to do that show 22 years ago at mm-hmm. Playcrafters. Played the opposite, the other role. But we did that show and Stephanie Nau was the director. And she had us in frock coats and period costume pieces for the whole show. But Dana Skiles directing this production didn't go that route. She wanted the eerie effects and the makeup and the lights and sound.
It's true. The acting was so good. I didn't even recognize it until the second act started. And all of a sudden, it kind of bopped me between the eyes that you were in modern dress for the most part.
You know, black pants, you know, sports jacket or white shirt and suspenders for
but
Patrick.
But I loved the way that played, that you just... And that it was on stage in those cubes, that you could just pull that out. And those changes were not made in the usual blue light. They just dimmed the regular lights. And that was a kind of a different aspect, too, that kind of made things stand out.
We tried to go as quickly as we could, too, to keep the pace of the show moving along.
Well, you did an excellent job. I thought it was very, very well done. But the costume, if you've...
They were more comfortable for us. I'm not going to complain. I'm certainly more comfortable to be wearing slacks and a turtleneck than a frock coat and cummerbund and top hat.
Well, it also illustrates, is the word I think I want, that a really well-written script and well-acted... that those peripherals are, while they're important to a point, you can take something and make a good show despite that. And anybody who listens to my reviews know that I'm a stickler on anachronisms.
Yes, we know.
Yes, we know.
I think it also highlights the fact that every performance is different, unique. Mm-hmm. I mean, every director has their own take on how a show should be staged. And you can see The Woman in Black at Playcrafters 10 years ago with Adam Cerny, and see it again at Richmond Hill with Patrick Kelly and myself this year, and it's a completely different show. It's just because the title is the same does not mean you're watching the same thing that you saw 10 years ago. It's going to be a different experience.
And maybe even, I'm just thinking of this now, the modern costuming, The Woman in Black is in the
period piece.
By having both kind of costuming, it gives that script more of a universal appeal.
I'll take that, sure.
Because, assuming, you could say that show, instead of saying 1905, you could say present day. And then she is just a specter from the past. See? He doesn't believe me. You should
I'm
see
nodding,
the look in
I'm
his
nodding,
eyes.
I'm nodding, but I'm trying to think about how to, I don't like changing scripts. So I wouldn't transport this playwright script from, 1905, where he said it, to the present day.
Well, for a long, long time.
I'd write my own script if I wanted to.
You and I share that in common. I have this funny view about the idea that, and it goes along with what you were saying, Jim, about every production being a little different and every director envisioning it a little differently, but at its core, to me, directing a play is trying to give the playwright's work a genuine interpretation. And if I wanted to do, say, Shakespeare in modern day, which a lot of companies have done, it is no longer novel, I guess that's fine. But I don't think that always translates well to contemporary theater. So,
well, there's also the aspect of the playwright vision for the action was in that time period. And for a long, long time, because of my involvement at Genesius Guild, I was a purist. I did not like the idea of setting Shakespeare in modern time until I saw Romeo and Juliet at the Black Rep Theater in St. Louis, and instead of Verona, it was set in 1960s St. Louis. And instead of a banquet scene, it was a backyard barbecue. The apothecary was this little, she was no bigger than a minute, but no bigger than a minute, grandma age. And she just flit around that stage. They had her in a psychedelic leotard. And that changed my mind on that it could be done in different dress. And since then, we've gone to the Illinois Shakespeare Festival in Bloomington, Illinois. And they've done several different eras. They did The Merry Wives in 1950s. They did Love's Labor's Lost in, I don't know what's, year or century, but when they had the big wigs in France with the bows on the men wore bows on their shoes and that type of thing. And so I have accepted more Shakespeare in modern dress, but I agree that I think you should stick with the vision of the playwright.
They say it comes down to selling tickets. I mean, if no one wants to come see Shakespeare anymore, you can't sell tickets and the theater's going to close. Or if no one wants to see Death of a Salesman anymore because it's too depressing, then they shouldn't do dramas. They should do comedies like 39 Steps. And I like to think that a play with a timeless theme, mm-hmm. about love or family or country or justice, can still be done and can still appeal to a contemporary audience. And I'm old enough that I can say that for myself, I would just want to keep trying to do that, to reach out to the contemporary audiences with the classic shows and see if maybe we can't just sell just enough tickets to be a purist, like you say.
Well, you told me, Jake, that Harvey was far more successful box office-wise than everybody expected.
Yeah, it filled their house for four performances. They do four performances, six performances. And that hadn't been done at Playcrafters for a very, very long time. And it helped that season. I think it may be that and Barefoot in the Park were like the two, and there may be others. Both comedies and both sort of tried and true comedies, which doesn't mean when you program a season that you pick only that kind of work. You have to know your patron base. And while you're always trying to attract new patrons, you also have to understand what your
demographic.
Yeah, it's a balancing act.
And it isn't just age demographic, it's interest demographic. And, you know, some theaters and some communities are far more family-oriented than others. I found in the Quad Cities, particularly on the Iowa side of the river, and it may be the same on this side as well, that so many things are geared toward families. And there's others that, which is not to say you only do, you know, family-type or family-themed shows, but that mindset is there. So musical theater, for example, the age group of folks raising families are different now. They're younger. So, for example, at Music Hill, a show like Margaritaville, which is not one of my favorite plays, but did well because it resonated well with a lot of that age group.
Exactly.
I applaud the fact that they're doing more newer shows. For example, they did Kinky Boots. They did not that it's a new show, but it's sort of newer to the area. Sweeney Todd. It's a Sondheim. Tends to appeal to a younger theater base.
You're in Town. They did a few years ago. Music Guild.
What? Yep. What was that about? I didn't see that.
Please. I couldn't give you a synopsis.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing it and enjoying the show.
Sure. Having managed a number of theaters, having owned a number of theater companies, when you're planning a season, it's exactly what Jim was saying. You are looking at shows that your base, your patron base wants to see and will attend. You can also program in things that might expand that base. But if you do it the other way around, program a season of shows that are totally alien to your theater base. I don't just mean age-wise, but just concept-wise and so on. You're toying with financial disaster, basically. And unfortunately, a lot of theater companies across the country don't get that, and a lot of theater companies across the country have an enormously high failure rate. So I was going to ask your opinion and also take the liberty of asking you, Chris, because I never get to ask you questions when I sit in as a guest host or a co-host, but why do you suppose it is that on the other side of the river, that there's no large-scale theater program on the Iowa side of the river? It's all on Moline. All in Moline. And Genesee, of course.
Well, that's a very good question. I think before you got to the Quad Cities, there were...
Are you blaming this on me?
No. No, I'm blaming it on the epidemic. Before you got to the Quad Cities, there was a theater group. Well, first there was, most recently, was Mockingbird.
Yeah.
There was Quad City Theater Workshop. They did some really good shows. And Prenzi Players. Yeah. Prenzi Players and New Ground. There were theaters over there. They didn't survive the pandemic.
But what I'm asking is why?
Why?
Well, we still have countryside.
We had the pandemic in Moline, too. So I'm just curious about it. I was here during the pandemic, by the way.
I know you were here during the pandemic. Yeah. I wasn't sure whether you had the opportunity to see New Ground or Quad City Theater Workshop or any of those.
New Ground, yes.
New Ground. So, yeah, I don't know why.
For decades, I blamed it on the legalization of gambling. When the casinos started to open in the late 90s and the early 2000s, the attendance at a place like Playcrafters, which used to sell 60 to 70% of its seats every show for the run, for the year, the attendance started to drop off because I think there are only so many entertainment dollars in a family budget, and people started spending them on the riverboats. That was the new form of entertainment, and that they started taking money, and the theater started getting less of the entertainment dollars that were available to spend. I don't know. I have no
That's a good thought. That's certainly, but that would not explain
the continuing decline.
The theater's continuing on our side of the river because the casinos are not that far away to take audience from our side.
I have not noticed that theater goers on the Iowa side have disappeared. They're just attending theater in Moline. So I just have always been curious about that as kind of an outsider watching that phenomenon. And I
had not thought of that, but that's very true.
Well, for today, let's say it's the fluoride in the water.
Well,
let's not go there.
Out in the lobby, Jim and I were also talking about demographics of the Geneseo audience. And the majority of shows Richmond Hill does are farces, comedies, and shows like The Woman in Black and Silent Sky don't do as well because that area, the people out there seem to don't want to get into deeper, more challenging scripts. They just want to be entertained.
I only have the ancillary anecdotes. I mean, when I was cast in Death of a Salesman, I was so pleased and proud. First thing I did after the director called me and offered me the part was got on the phone and called my parents, both still living at the time.
You've been in it twice. Which role are you talking
about? I got the Willie Loman
role. When you got Willie Loman, okay.
And I called home to the East Coast and said, I'm going to play Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. And my mom said, well, that's a drama. We're not going to come and see that. When we go to the theater, we want to be entertained. Made me sad. You can be entertained by a drama.
Exactly.
But they only like to go out and see the comedies.
My parents never came to any of my shows. I take that back. They went, I was Frocine in The Miser at Black Hawk College. They came to that. But for 30 years at Genesius Guild, they never came to one show. Broke my heart, really, it did.
Now, my parents did drive out for the Kane Mutiny Court-Martial, my first show, to support me in my new endeavor. So I was pleased with that.
So you're saying your mom didn't come from the East Coast to watch you play Willie Loman?
She did not.
Oh, how sad.
Oh, well, And, you know, with all the copyright laws, you're not allowed to take video, so there's no film that I could send to her. I send her the links to the reviews, so she reads your reviews and Jonathan Turner's
reviews. But you were their New England man. You were vital in New England.
I was. I didn't have to do the accent for that part. So many of the local theaters do shows with English accents or Southern accents, and I find that more difficult now. The longer I stay here, the more I feel like I have the flat Midwestern voice. I've lost my New England twang. My parents are from the Bronx. My mother has a Bronx accent when I want to. I don't have to watch TV to get the New York accent. I just have to call home.
I have never been really good at it, especially Scottish. I can't get a Scottish.
It's hard to maintain it for a two-hour show. And if you slip, the reviewers notice or the audiences notice. And it takes you out of the moment for a production.
Well,
so
Patrick did a wonderful job with the accent. He really did.
There's a lot of people around here that are very good with accents. Jennifer Kingery instructs in the different type of British Isle accents that she wants for her shows based on the locales.
That's what I noticed with Kevin Babbitt. I think in just one show, and which was probably the 39 Steps, and also...
Oh, when he played the actor and he had, you know,
I can't remember his first name, Lord, Larry Lord?
Larry Lord.
He did several different accents in 39 Steps, and I was just blown away by that, because I can do a very bad British accent.
Yeah, I end up sounding like Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins, I think, to my way of thinking when I try and do English. Or I'll sit and watch old Rex Harrison movies for a while, if it's supposed to be a highfalutin sounding English accent. I'll try and mimic him to the best of my ability, just for something passable.
Going back to the musicals, I agree with everything you said, but I still would like at least one of the old ones, like Man of La Mancha or...
I'm a Rodgers and Hammerstein fan myself, yeah. South Pacific.
Well, Chris, you land on, you know, one of the subtle battles that go on in musical theater. It's contemporary musical theater versus classic musical theater. And the cutoff is somewhere around the 1960s. You know, the classic book shows that you're both are talking
and part
about.
Of it, Carousel, that's what I was trying to think of. Many years ago, when I babysat kids, one of my regular customers had albums of Carousel and whatever, whatever. And after the kids were in bed, I'd put those records on. And one of the things I really like about the older musicals is that you walk out of the theater humming the music. A lot of the modern, they're good while you're there, but they don't stick with you when you leave the theater. At least they don't stick with me.
And I think the last point is a point. And that is, a lot of younger audiences, it does, because their ear is trained for that. Whereas we, the age group in this studio at the moment, did not. We grew up with lyrics that were discernible. And more than one sentence, generally repeated over
and over. We also had the advantage of a lot of the famous stage musicals being converted to Hollywood blockbusters.
Exactly.
So West Side Story and Oklahoma and Carousel. You could watch the movie a few times, and that would help the music stick into your head. You'd buy the LP and listen to it on the record player after school or work.
Sure.
I can still sing Mr. Snow from Carousel.
You know, Carousel isn't done frequently any longer. And, of course, the reason is the theme of it, you know. Husband beating up the wife in a musical generally.
And, you know, we ran into that. We ran into something sort of similar in...
Or I should say a husband beating up his pregnant wife is not generally the material.
Well, Stanley Kowalski, they did it at Playgrounders. One of my lines from Miss Nelson involved, And we did the first performance. None of us thought of it, and it was so blatant that we should have. And fortunately, one of my former bosses, when I worked at Montgomery Elevator, we're friends on Facebook, and she messaged me about that, with school shootings, that was, so we took it. I mean, we took it out, but it was like, how did we miss that? And especially because the director is a former teacher. I don't know, maybe she's still teaching, I don't know. But that was...
Well, that's a challenge with doing older shows, because they were written when times were different.
Of course.
I'm not saying better or worse, just different. There were stereotypes that were in play that are no longer...
Well, the same thing with Hairspray that Countryside did this summer.
It was very difficult to do To Kill a Mockingbird just because of the language in the script. I heard from Patrick Kelly, who was in Of Mice and Men last year, that the original script had some language in it that just isn't spoken on stage anymore, especially at family-oriented community theaters. And they had to wrestle with what they were going to do with the N-word or with references like that.
And I think absolutely. And I mean, that's always a concern when you're directing a play. And
you don't want the language to overwhelm the story or...
Right. I mean, even with Neil Simon comedies, what he deals with in making jokes about certain things that are ethnic stereotypes just don't fly today. And of course, you know, even a show as benign as The Fantastics has an entire comedic song about rape, which has been the modern working version of that has been completely rewritten as a result. Because you can't do that on stage so any longer. So, you know, what you're saying is absolutely true. But let's also keep in mind a lot of the movies you're talking about, the filmed version of, you know, standard book shows, some of them are pretty dreadful too, like Finian's Rainbow and the filmed version of Man of La Mancha, and many of those that were filmed in the 60s and 70s were real duds.
And playwrights change their plays too, which I was not aware of when I first started doing community theater. And a friend of mine just reminded me of this on Saturday, because she's still amused by it 20 years later. We did Another Part of the Forest at Richmond Hill Theater.
I am not familiar with that script.
Oh, it's a Southern drama. Jackie Skiles played my mom, and back then I liked to memorize my part before going into the first reading. I want to be prepared. So it was a long drive out there. I didn't want to drive all the way out there to get my script, so I went to the library and checked out the script for Another Part of the Forest, and I memorized it before the first read-through. And we got to the read-through, and we started reading the play, and the first act was fine. But we got to the second half of the show, and it was my line, and I didn't think it was my line because I had memorized my part. And said, "Jim, your line." I said, "No, it's not." "Yeah, here, look at the script." And I said, and I looked at it, and it was completely different. She had entirely rewritten the second half of the show since the first publication of the play, and I had memorized an older version, and everyone was laughing at me.
Was that difficult to read?
To unmemorize half of a show and rememorize it again? Yes, it was very difficult.
I would think it would be.
But Jackie's still making fun of me to this day about that. When I say I have to get a script and see if it's a show I want to do, and say, "Don't memorize it, Jim, until we actually, you know, get the script that's official from the director."
The working version.
Yeah, the current working version. Don't check scripts out of the library and memorize what they have there. That's my advice.
Well, Jim, it's been a delight talking with you. Thank you so much for being a guest. And thank you, Jake, for stepping in as co-host.
My pleasure.
Okay, well, this, again, is Footlights. And I forgot how we sign off.
Do you want me to tell you?
Yeah.
Well, Jim, we always say break a leg. So, break a leg.
Thanks for listening to Footlights, a community theater podcast from the Quad Cities. Footlights is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. If you'd like to explore more podcasts from WVIK or support our work, you can do that at wvik.org or by downloading the WVIK app.